This is Phil Farron.
And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It has been a good week. Got a lot of things accomplished this week. It is episode 627, I think. I officially started book 15 this week. There's been enough little things going on. I was actually ahead a little bit. Today is the official start because it's April the 1st. But I got my documents set up and, got all that process started. And I won't have any trouble at all. Shouldn't have any trouble at all hitting 10,000 words this week because I've got all the terminology, the characters and settings and all that stuff. And so that just adds a bunch of stuff. I mean, I start at like 6,700 words now because there's been so much that has gone ahead. This first week is pretty easy, which is good because I'm easing back into it. And I've been working on Talk Like Shakespeare Day costume at the same time, so it's been nice to have a little more breathing room in there. This was, I think, my last week at home working. Maybe. I don't know. We'll see. I may have a conversation with the people I work with. Working at home does save me an hour a day, which is a lot of time. Because my commute's 20 minutes, and then, of course, you get cleaned up to work at home, but it's different than getting cleaned up to actually, go into work because you have to, actually get dressed and blah, 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 blah. So, but we'll see. We'll see. If it's time to start going back into work, we'll go back into work. So it'll be just fine. Puttering along there. Wasn't quite as productive as I should have been today for work because apparently my mouse was going bad. I noticed it yesterday that sometimes I'd click and I'd get a double click and it just got progressively worse, but I was able to work with it yesterday, slowed me down a little bit. And then it just seemed to get progressively worse today. Finally, I got to the point where I just had to abandon it, get another mouse and get it in there. But I've got on order. I've got a new set coming in. So we'll get that taken care of. It was funny because it started to really double click on me. And then it started to double click in places I didn't. My program out. I was working and started throwing errors, and I was like, whoa, okay, we're done. So got that swapped out. Once I got that swapped out, everything was fine. The books for the beta readers should be in next week. I have a few more slots open for beta reading, but I'm going to hop on Facebook this weekend. Write one more email to the previous beta readers. Say, okay, this is where we are. If anybody wants to read this one, let me know. Otherwise, I'll put it up on Facebook. So I'll do that this weekend as well. Books come in. Get those mailed next week. Keep working on book 15.
So that's going fine.
Talk Like Shakespeare, sorry. At the end of that 40-plus hour fast. So Talk Like Shakespeare outfit is going fine. Got a little rambunctious last night when I was working on some pieces. I think I'm going to have to rip one of the pieces apart and put another piece back in because I just got a little conservative in my measurements and it's too short. But we'll get that all done. It'll be fine. It's interesting. It's interesting because this outfit is actually an outfit of a drawing of Henry III of France, who was somewhat flamboyant in his outfits. And it's like lavender and red, with tights and the whole business, because they were doing that during that whole Shakespearean time. And I've showed the picture to a couple of my buddies who you would not expect would necessarily think, I wouldn't classify it as the most masculine outfit in the world, and yet I've shown it to two buddies now and gotten the same response from them. They look at it and go, oh, that's kind of cool. And one of them said, yeah, I'd wear that. I mean, it's very interesting. It's just very interesting. So it's going to be interesting to see where this costume, which is from a time when men did dress like this, and it is obviously, if you know men dressed like that, it is obviously a male costume. It will be interesting to see what the reaction from the men will be to this costume. I mean, even my wife, when I showed it to her, she said, well, that's how men dressed then. So it's very interesting. It is obviously not modern dress. And perhaps because it's obviously not modern dress and comes from a time when men's clothing was what the costume is, then there's no dissonance with whether it's a feminine or masculine piece of cloth. I don't know. It's very interesting. I had not expected that reaction because it has leggings, basically, and big poofy shorts, you know. And it's just very interesting. It's just very, very interesting. Anyway, so all is well there. Everything's good with the family. I was just in at church, and we set up the video for the Good Friday service and for the Sunday service and got all that squared away and under control. This week, I just came across a little article that I thought, oh, that's interesting. And it's just fascinating for me to watch people work through this time we are in, trying to figure out how to live within the dissonance and the discord and the dissension and the strife and the tribalization, trying to figure out how to live within that. It's just really interesting to me. So the name of this article was 150 years ago, a philosopher showed why it's pointless to start arguments on the internet. This is by Olivia Goldhill. So she starts off the article by saying, wildly inaccurate facts and spurious arguments are unavoidable features of social media. Yet, no matter how infuriatingly wrong someone is, or just how much counter evidence you have at your disposal, starting arguments on the internet rarely gets anyone to change their mind. Nearly a century and a half ago, British philosopher John Stuart Mill explained in a few clear sentences why certain arguments simply won't go anywhere. As historian Robert Saunders notes, Mill's analysis neatly applies to heated and futile internet debate. Now, this is where I would pause and say, why does something that a philosopher said 150 years ago easily still apply to things that are going on in our quote-unquote modern age with our modern tools, with our modern ways of communicating? And the reason that it applies is because what we are experiencing is not modern, It is primal. And it exists no matter what tools you're using. Okay, so John Mill says, John Stuart Mill said this. So long as an opinion is strongly rooted in feelings, it gains rather than loses in stability by having a preponderating weight of argument against it. For if it were accepted as the result of argument, the refutation of argument might shake the solidity of the conviction. But when it rests solely on feeling, the worse it fares in argumentative contest. Oh, for when it rests solely on feelings, comma, the worse it fares in argumentative contest, the more persuaded its adherents are that their feeling must have some deeper ground which arguments do not reach. And while the feeling remains, it is always throwing up fresh entrenchments of arguments to repair any breach made in the old. Okay, so he calls this feelings, which is fine. But basically what he's saying is that if you are driven by a certain thing, what he terms feelings, that you really cannot speak to that rationally, because you can try to establish rational arguments, but what is going to happen is beneath all your attempts to establish rational arguments, there will simply be what my mom used to do when I would talk and talk and talk and talk, and finally, logically and reasonably, pin her to the wall to where she had no recourse. Zero recourse. And at that point, there would be nothing else she could say, and she would respond with, "Nope, I'm right." And that was the end of it. Nope, I'm right. So this is what he calls feelings, that no matter if you are argument or if you are trying to discuss something with a person whose argument is based in feelings, it doesn't matter what evidence or facts you present, a person on the other side, their feelings remain, and their feelings, according to John Stuart Mill, are always throwing up fresh entrenchments of arguments to repair any breach made in the old. So back to the article. Mill highlights the often overlooked reality that many opinions aren't based on facts at all, but feelings. And so contradictory points of information don't shift emotionally rooted arguments, but only cause people to dig in deeper. The article goes on, intuitively, most people recognize that emotions motivate opinions and behave accordingly. We use rhetorical techniques such as verbal flourishes and confident mannerisms to help convince others of our views. And we know that angry reactions to, for example, evidence showing that children of the same-sex parents fare just as well as those raised by heterosexual parents are grounded in emotional prejudice rather than any deep-seated desire for the facts. Okay, all right, so studies reinforce these instincts about the importance of emotions. For example, patients who have brain damage in areas responsible for processing emotions also struggle to make decisions, pointing to the importance of emotions in deciding between two options. As chartered psychologist Rob Jung, whose book How to Stand Out emphasizes the effectiveness of emotions rather than logic in convincing others to agree with you, points to research showing that the use of metaphors motivate people to make decisions. Online, you can't see others' faces or moods It's easy to grow lose sight of these emotional instincts. Instead of engaging with and respecting others' feelings, there can be a tendency to bombard those with opposing views with facts, quote unquote, in the article, quote unquote. But even seemingly solid points of information, such as the periodic table, are often grounded in subjective perspectives. Well, I missed this part when I was putting together my notes. A broad philosophical theory called social constructivism that argues that facts are always a reflection of socially constructed values. Okay, well, all right. So there are often multiple ways of interpreting a single point of information, and so much though some people might like to think they're right about everything, there are surprisingly few issues to which there is an unequivocally correct opinion. That's very relativistic. That's, yeah, in the article. So she goes on to say, perhaps there's little hope of convincing others on the internet to change their minds. But as Sanders notes, Mill does point to another approach. Okay, we're back to Mills now. Every circumstance which gives a character to the life of a human being carries with it a peculiar bias, its particular facilities for perceiving some things and for missing or forgetting others. But from points of view different from his, different things are perceptible, and none are more likely to have seen what he does not see than those who do not see what he sees. The keenest detectors of errors of his predecessors and of the inaccuracies of current models of thought is the very person who needs most to fortify the weak side of his own intellect. By study of the opinion of mankind in all ages and nations and of these speculations of philosophers and the modes of thought, blah, blah, blah. In other words, what he's saying is, like, no matter who you're having the conversation with, you should probably pause and, you know, listen to what they're saying and then reflect on that. And so the article ends by saying, instead of seeking to convince others, we can be open to changing our own minds and seek out information that contradicts our own steadfast point of view. Maybe it'll turn out that those who you disagree with actually have a solid grasp of the facts. There's a slight possibility, after all, that you're the one who's wrong. And I absolutely agree with that. Absolutely. You know, you've always got to be very careful. And especially you've got to be very careful of any situation and circumstance where you are having a big emotional reaction to something. Because you can pretty much count on the fact that if you're having a big emotional reaction, a big negative emotional reaction, you're angry, you are jealous, you are envious, you are lustful, you are disturbed, all of that dissension, all of that stuff is flesh. And when they talk about feelings in this article, my interpretation would be that what they're really talking about is flesh. Because feelings on their own, you know, when he talks about the fact that no matter what arguments you make, then these feelings, quote unquote, come in and shore up the breach and make all sorts of other counter arguments. Okay, well, that's more than just an emotion. That is something that is comprehending what is being said, is comprehending when that starts to make sense, and then is comprehending how to build a counter argument that will have enough emotive content that will push back and cloud any logical or factual argument that's trying to be made. See, there's a whole lot of intention there. There's a whole lot of planning. There's a whole lot of intelligence there. And just calling it feelings, I don't think does it justice. I have been in conversations before with individuals who would just spout off stuff that was like half true. And then I'd say, well, that's true, but, you know, that is qualified by this. And then they'd just look at me like, oh, and then they'd spout off something else. I mean, and then when I'd get to the place where I would prove something, well, I would prove it to my satisfaction and apparently theirs, the response would be, well, but people wouldn't do that. And it's like, well, wait a minute. At one point I had to look at another person who was in the conversation and go, and the other person looked at the first person and went, yeah, they would. They would? They would. Because I have seen this in action. Now, the key here, I think, the key, the tells to look for in this are the tells of negative emotion. Those are the tells to look for. And if you see a person who is remaining calm, who is talking calmly, who you can discuss with, that's a person that you have the potential to learn something from well, and also potentially has the ability to learn from you. But if you've got someone who's just railing and angry and jealous and envious and all those things, absolutely, you know, there's really not much point in having those kind of discussions. And Jesus had a pretty strident way of identifying that situation. That if you've got somebody who's just spouting off, who is not really thinking about what they're saying, who's just trying to score points, Jesus' advice is, you know, you really should just stop. And how he puts it, and maybe it's a proverb, I have to look it up. There is something interesting about this phraseology, but he says, you know, don't cast your pearls before swine, because you won't get any response and they'll just turn on you. So I absolutely agree that if you see someone who's possessed of flesh and they're really argumentative and they're, you know, you should just back your way out of the conversation. Just say, you know, I'm sorry. I don't really participate in these types of conversations, as I've had to do at times. You know, I'm not going to talk about us versus them. I'm not going to talk about, you know, critical theory and all those things to a person who's convinced. I'm just not going to do it. The only exception I will make, and I have made this exception, is that if I'm with friends who know me and I know them, and if I need to raise my voice to get their attention, I will do that. And I will contend with them. But I'm contending with them not because I'm upset and I don't like what they're saying. I am contending with them because I'm trying to at least get them to consider the fact that they might be possessed of flesh in that moment. And if I can do that, it means that I have the potential to put them on a better road to success, because that possession by the flesh, it's not demonic possession, it's just possession by the flesh. That possession by the flesh is always destructive in every area of our lives. You can't keep it confined. So if I see that someone is really being possessed and driven by their flesh, if I can wake them up and get them to pause and get them to think for a minute, it means I might actually save them grief down the road. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.